This is my first shot at this, so I'm going to try to follow the same basic format that Bill did, and we'll start off by giving the title of the book. I see that I may not have written quite hard enough because it didn't come through very well. The title of the book in Hebrew is based upon the name of the prophet, whose name is Yehezkel or Ezekiel. The name of this man, like many of the other prophets, reveal the message of the book. The man's name means either God strengthens or God is strong. Many of the commentators feel that the name means God strengthens, and the message of the book of Ezekiel then would be that God strengthens the faithful remnant in view of the imminent judgment by means of prophecies of restoration. However, I believe on the basis of the form of the noun itself and on the basis of the contents of the book that the name should mean something like God is strong. And I see the purpose of the book as God's sovereign power. God's sovereign power in the punishment of Judah for its sins. God's sovereign power in the judgment on the nations. And God's sovereign power in the restoration of Israel. God is sovereign in judgment of his people. Those who sin against him will die. And God pronounces judgment upon Jerusalem for their sins. The nations, when God judged Jerusalem, mocked at God. They mocked at Israel. And consequently, God will judge the nations. The final manifestation of God's sovereign power will be in the restoration of Israel, which took place after the Babylonian captivity in a partial sense, but will take place in a full sense in the millennial reign of Jesus Christ and the rebuilding of the temple in the land of Palestine. So I believe the title then manifests the purpose and the theme of the book, which is that God is strong. God is sovereign in power. And I believe you get that in the very first chapter in the vision of Ezekiel of the cherubim, the wheels, the pavement, the throne, that manifests the glory of God. The second thing that Bill normally takes up is the authorship and the authenticity of the book. We have to dig a little bit to find anyone who challenges the authenticity and the authority of this book. This book was accepted by the Jews, according to Ecclesiasticus 49:8. It was accepted as authoritative, as one of the prophets, because of the visions and because of the revelations that Ezekiel had. However, one of the schools of the rabbis questioned the authenticity of this book. This was questioned by the school of Shammai in the first century A.D., and it was questioned around three basic passages. First of all, the passage in Ezekiel 16, which deals with the unfaithful woman that God redeemed in the wilderness, was deemed to be too repugnant. This was too repugnant to be read in the synagogue, and consequently Shammai thought that the chapter did not reflect good taste. The second reason that it was rejected was on the basis of the vision in Ezekiel chapter 1. The Jews of this period believed in rejecting all specific revelation of God. They turned the specific revelations of God into anthropomorphisms, and they thought this was too theosophical. That is, it was too close to the doctrines of mysteries and the doctrine of the revelation of God. However, the prime reason for rejecting the book of Ezekiel by this school was the vision in Ezekiel 40 through 48. This was too contradictory to the laws of Moses or to the Torah. The teaching of Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48 presupposed a new temple. It presupposed a new ministry, and it presupposed new sacrifices, all of which were difficult for the rabbis to fit into the scheme of the Mosaic law. However, as a result of some study on the part of the rabbis. This book was accepted into the Jewish canon at the Council of Jamnia. It was the authority of the book, which had always been recognized by believing Israelites, was received a stamp of approval by this council in A.D. 90. The book was not questioned until 1924. The unity and authenticity of this book was not questioned until 1924. I have done a great deal of studying in the German rationalist schools, the humanists, and none of the humanists nor none of the rationalists were able to bring an attack against the book of Ezekiel until 1924. When they did, it was a rather ridiculous attack based upon the presupposition that Ezekiel was a poet, reject everything that's not poetic in the book. That is the way it started. Some of the liberals and some of the rationalists and some of the humanists, however, reject the book today on the basis that the book claims to have been written from Babylon, that Ezekiel claims to be writing from the country of Babylon, from the exiles in Babylonia, and they know, on the basis of some of the material in the book, that he did not write from Babylon, but he wrote from Palestine. The reason they say that they know that is because the information that Ezekiel has on Palestine is too specific. Ezekiel knows what's going on in the land of Palestine, in the temple, and he is supposed to be in Babylon. Some of the information that they use for this is the death of one of the elders in chapter 11, verse 3, and the escape of the king Zedekiah in chapter 12, verses 3 through 12, and the siege of Jerusalem in chapter 24, 2. They claim that Ezekiel knew too much about what was going on at Palestine at the time of the writing of this book not to have been in Palestine. However, there are two answers to that criticism. Information passed back and forth between the exiles in Babylon and between the besieged inhabitants of Jerusalem quite readily. You see this in Jeremiah chapter 29. You see it in Ezekiel chapter 33 when one of the refugees from the destroyed city comes to Ezekiel and informs him of what is going on in the city of Jerusalem. The other thing that you need to keep in mind is that a rationalist or a humanist rejects out of hand the fact that God can reveal something to a man like Ezekiel. And Ezekiel claims much of his knowledge on the basis of the fact that God appeared to him in a vision, or that God, by the Spirit, took him up and transported him to another place. And so much of the information that is gained in this book is on the basis of the Spirit of God. It's not on the basis of Ezekiel being in Jerusalem at all. If we were to believe the attacks, many of the prophets would have had to go specifically to the nation against which they preached to make their proclamations of judgment. That is, some of the other prophets, Nahum, would have had to been actually in Nineveh. He would have had to been in Nineveh to know what was going on in Nineveh. He could not have had such specific knowledge. But God, through His Spirit, revealed certain truths to these prophets. Okay, so most of your critics today will accept that the book is a unified whole, that it comes from Ezekiel. It's only some of the more rationalistic higher critics that do not believe that the book was actually written by Ezekiel and that it is a unified whole, that it was written in the country of Babylon. Now, as far as the historical background goes, we need to keep in mind some of the firm dates of Bible chronology. I think Bill has been going through this with you. First of all, we know that Jeremiah was called in 627. In 622, Ezekiel was born. In 621, the book of the law was discovered. And so Ezekiel was a priest living near the temple of Jerusalem. He undoubtedly was caught up in the revival of the that followed the book of the law, when Josiah caused the people of Israel to enter into a covenant with Jehovah that they would obey the law, that they would study the law, and that they would do the law. So Ezekiel had a very good foundation. The early years of his life, the first 12 years of his life, came before Josiah died in 609. And Ezekiel, being a priest near the temple, would have had access to the study of the law. In 609, Josiah was killed at the Battle of Megiddo. And one of his sons was put on the throne of Israel by the people of the land. He was immediately deposed by the Egyptian king. And a king who was a vassal of the Egyptian king was set up on the throne until 605. And in 605, Daniel was taken captive to Babylon when Nebuchadnezzar defeated the Egyptian forces at Carchemish. 3 years later, after this, about 601, this particular king, Jehoiakim, rebelled again. He rebelled against the king of Babylon, and the king of Babylon sent forces against Jerusalem, and another group of captives was taken off. Among this group of captives was the priest Ezekiel, who was taken captive in the year 697. Ezekiel's call to the ministry came in 692, 5 years after he had been in exile, and he ministered until 592, and the siege of Jerusalem began in 588, the city fell in 586, and Ezekiel ministered all during this time. We need to take a look at some of the chronological background of this book. I have given you a chronological overview, but we need to take a look at some of the chronological backbone of this book to establish this chronology itself. So let's take a look, first of all, at Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 21. Now, it came about in the 12th year of our exile, on the 5th of the 10th month, that the refugees from Jerusalem came to me, saying, "The city has been taken." The city of Jerusalem fell in the year 586, and the fifth day of the 10th month of the 12th year would be approximately January the 5th of 585. The city fell perhaps in August of 586, so it took some time. It took about 6 months or more for the refugee to come from the city. So consequently, when he says it came about in the 12th year of our exile, on the 5th of the 10th month, 12 years plus 585, when the city fell, gives you the date when Ezekiel was carried into exile. 12 plus 585 gives you 597. One other reference in the book gives you the same date. In the 25th year of our exile, 25 years he's been in exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year after the city was taken, on that same day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me there. So the 25th year of Ezekiel's exile and the 14th year after the capture of the city of Jerusalem are the same. So working back 25 minus 14, you get 11 years between the capture of Jerusalem and the taking of Ezekiel into exile. Ezekiel went into exile in 597. So both of these references tell us that Ezekiel went into exile at 597. Ezekiel was a peculiar man in the sense that he had to undergo not only the judgment of God on the nation of Judah, he also had to be around, he had to preach to people who had undergone God's judgment and who were looking forward to the restoration. Jeremiah did not have to face this. Jeremiah ended his ministry not long after the city of Jerusalem fell. Daniel preached to the captives. Pardon me, Daniel preached to the court, and so Daniel did not preach primarily to the captives. Ezekiel was a man who saw the judgment of God upon the land of Judah in these three deportations. The deportation in 605, the deportation in 697, and the fall of Jerusalem in 586. He had seen the hand of God fall in judgment. And consequently, Ezekiel's prophecies had been vindicated in his own lifetime, that Jerusalem would fall. And so when Ezekiel turns to prophecies of restoration, he comes as an authenticated prophet. He had promised the fall, the destruction of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem had fallen. And now he stands as a prophet authenticated by God through fulfilled prophecy. Okay, the other reference that we need to pick up here is found in chapter 1 and 2 of Ezekiel 1. Now it came about in the 30th year, on the 5th day of the 4th month, while I was by the river Kebar among the exiles, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the 5th of the month, in the 5th year of King Jehoiakim's exile. So Ezekiel begins his prophecy on the 5th month of the 5th year of his exile. When he went into exile was the same time as King Jehoiakim went into exile, 597. And he did not begin his prophecy until 592. He prophesied for approximately 22 years. The last dated prophecy in the book of Ezekiel is in the 27th year of his exile, and that is found in Ezekiel chapter 29, verse 17. So he prophesied for 22 years. Let's look at the conditions of Judah at the time that Ezekiel prophesied. The political conditions varied around the nations of Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt. When Josiah took the throne, Assyria was in full power. But Josiah cast off the yoke of Assyrian bondage, cleansed the land of all Assyrian idolatry, did away with the high places, cleansed the temple, and during the cleansing of the temple in 621, the priest Hilkiah discovered the law, and Josiah entered into the covenant with the people of Israel and Jehovah God that they would keep the covenant of the Lord as recorded in the law of Moses. They would read it periodically, they would obey it, and they would do it. He was followed by one of his sons who was taken into captivity, whom I do not have here, Jehoahaz, who reigned only 3 months. He was in turn followed by Jehoiakim, who was set upon the throne by the Egyptian Pharaoh, and he was a vassal of Pharaoh, doing the will of Pharaoh, obedient to Pharaoh, even to the point of neglect of God. The revival under Josiah lapsed, and the people began trusting in their alliances with Egypt. However, in 605, he came to the throne in 609, in 605, Nebuchadnezzar defeated Pharaoh Necho, and this caused a change in suzerain, change in overlord for this king Jehoiakim. He went wherever the power was. 3 years later, when he thought that Necho was stronger than Nebuchadnezzar, he shifted allegiance again, and he threw off the yoke of Babylon. You find this in the allegory in chapter 23, that all the time, Judah and Samaria were just like a couple of harlotry sisters. They went where they thought the power was. They went where the man was. They went where they thought the masculinity was, where the power was, and they did not follow God. They were just like harlotrous sisters. The next king, Jehoiachin, did not reign very long. He reigned actually 3 years before he was taken into captivity in 597. His father did him the disfavor of dying while Nebuchadnezzar was attacking the city of Jerusalem. And Jehoiachin spent the next 40 years of his life in captivity in Babylon. The final king was the king Zedekiah, and this king was a political opportunist as well. None of these kings, except the good king Josiah, was a godly king. All of these kings followed after alliances. They trusted in their horses, they trusted in their chariots, they trusted in the chariots and the horses of Egypt, or the chariots and horses of Babylon, and did not trust in God. And as you recall, in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah condemns them for that. Okay, some of the religious background, or some of the religious conditions, when Ezekiel begins prophesying, he is warned ahead of time by God that this people is a stubborn and rebellious people. Ezekiel chapter 2, verses 3, 4, and 5. Then he said to me, Son of man, I am sending you to the sons of Israel, to a rebellious people who have rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day. I am sending you to them who are stubborn and obstinate children. And you shall say to them, Thus saith the Lord God, As for them, whether they listen or not, for they are a rebellious house, they will know that a prophet has been among them. In verse 8 of chapter 3, Behold, I have made your head as hard as their faces, and your forehead as hard as their forehead. Like emery, harder than flint, I have made your forehead. So he compares the obstinacy and the rebellion and the stubbornness of the people of Israel to a whetstone, emery. They are as hard as whetstone. The prophecies of God, the judgments of God, have been just like steel on whetstone. They have not cut through the whetstone. They have not cut through the emery. And these people are stubborn. They are rebellious. They are hard-hearted. The other thing that characterized these people at this particular time was security. In Ezekiel chapter 12, verse 22, Son of man, what is this proverb you people have concerning the land of Israel, saying, The days are long and every vision fails. These people had suffered through two deportations. They had seen the deportation of Daniel in 605 and some of his friends. They had seen the deportation of Jehoiachin in 697 and Ezekiel and some of the nobility. And they had decided that the nations of the earth were not strong enough to take Zion. Zion, the city of our God, is impregnable. It's inviolable. God will not let the nations of the earth touch Jerusalem. And consequently, they developed a proverb that is repeated in Jeremiah. The city of the Lord, no one will take it. And the other thing that they did is, because God was long-suffering, because God did not visit them with the full blow of his judgment, they said that the prophecies for a long time off. That is, we're secure in the land. God is not going to punish us. The days are long, and every vision fails. That is, everything that Jeremiah has prophesied has not come to pass. The things that he's talking about are far distant. Jeremiah's prophecy will never come to pass. And so the people of the land were secure. The other thing that happened was that there were a number of false prophets, both in the land of Israel and also in the land of Babylon. Some of these false prophets you may have studied last time. Jeremiah, I believe it's chapter 28, speaks of one of these false prophets, Hananiah, who went so far as to make a prophecy that says, you're going to come back in a very short time. And Jeremiah had to rebuke Hananiah and tell him that this was not true. But there were also false prophets in the land of Babylon. And you find this in Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 4, 8, and 9. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Do not let your prophets who are in your midst and your diviners deceive you, and do not listen to the dreams which they have dreamed, for they prophesy falsely to you in my name. So Ezekiel is to speak to the ones who are, Jeremiah is to send to those who are in exile, and he's to tell those in exile that they are not to let their false prophets deceive them. In chapter 29, verses 21 through 23, a couple of these false prophets, one of these false prophets is even named. So we do know that Jeremiah had knowledge of a false prophet in the country of Babylon. And these false prophets were lulling the people to sleep, giving them a false sense of security, much like the liberal pulpiteer does day after day after day, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, who preaches the goodness of man when all around him the sinfulness of man is manifest. False prophets who masquerade in clothes of clerical garments. So they people have become secure. And the final thing that I want to look at is the fact that they condemn God. Some of them had become secure, and others had condemned God. Ezekiel chapter 18, verse 25. You say, the way of the Lord is not right. Hear now, O house of Israel, is my way not right? Is it not your ways that are not right? That is, Israel condemned God for judging them. They had gone into captivity, some of them. Some of them had been carried away in 605 and in 597. And they said, God is not righteous. God is not just in sending us into captivity. Why are we in captivity when some of our brethren are not in captivity? We are righteous and God is unjust. We have done nothing and God is evil. God has condemned us. The activities of these people, given in Ezekiel chapter 8, I do not want to go into that, but you have there a very detailed list of the idolatries of the nation. The people were worshiping images. Some of them were worshiping animals. Some had even descended to the fertility worship of the god Tammuz, who was a resurrection deity, and with whom fertility rites, prostitution, sacred marriage were practiced every year. So the fertility rites, sacred prostitution, sacred marriage had come into the land of Israel. The priests themselves were not exempt because they were worshiping the sun. They turned their back on the temple of Jehovah and turned toward the east and worshiped the sun. As a result of this blatant rejection of God, God is going to judge them. Okay, some of the contemporaries of Ezekiel, Jeremiah, ministered from 627 to 586. Daniel ministered from 605 to 533. And Ezekiel ministered from 592 to 597. Jeremiah ministered to the Jews in Jerusalem before the destruction of the city and slightly after the destruction of the city. Daniel ministered to the heathen kings in the court of Babylon, the kings of Babylon, the kings of Persia. Ezekiel ministered to those who had undergone captivity. He had the toughest job. Okay, now the purpose of the book. I think the purpose of the book is to demonstrate the sovereign power of the Lord. The key is found in this phrase, they shall know I am the Lord. I think as you read through the book, you may have picked that up, that this is a phrase that is constantly repeated throughout the book. They shall know that I am the Lord, that God is sovereign, that God is in control, that God is in power. In the ancient Near East, when a nation went into captivity, or when the people went into captivity, it was generally a sign that the god of that nation was weak. The gods of the victor were strong, and the gods of that nation who had been defeated were weak. God is declaring to Ezekiel and to the exiles that God is still in control, that God is sovereign, that he will punish the nation of Judah. And in Ezekiel chapter 24, you have one of these 70 occurrences of the phrase, they shall know that I am the Lord. The nations of the earth also will confess that God is the Lord when he judges them. Judgment will come upon the nations, and they too will confess that God is the Lord. And when Israel is restored, Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 13 and 14, the nation of Israel, the nations of the earth, will know that God is the Lord. So God is in control. God is sovereignly in power. Okay, now the character of the prophet. The prophet himself is a priest. You find this in Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 3. Now it came about in the 30th year on the 5th day of the 4th month, while I was by the river Kibar among the exiles, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. On the 5th of the month, in the 5th year of King Jehoiachin's exile, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kibar. Ezekiel was about 30 years old at this time. It came about in the 30th year. This is somewhat significant. A priest normally entered his ministry at the age of 30. Ezekiel had been carried off from the land of Palestine, did not have access to the temple of God, could not minister as a priest normally would minister, so God gave him another job. God gave him the job of being a prophet. Like Jeremiah, he was a priest. Priest by birth and a priest by training. But God called him and spoke through him. This, by the way, is helpful in looking at the book of Ezekiel because it gives you some idea of why Ezekiel emphasizes the holiness of God. The priests of all people decided questions of holiness. In Haggai chapter 2, the person comes to the priest and he says, "My garment has touched an unclean garment. Is my garment unclean?" And the priest could say, "It's unclean." And another man would come along and he'd say, "My garment has touched a holy garment. Is my garment holy?" And the priest would say, "No, it's not holy." So that the priest had the business of determining when something was clean and unclean, when it was holy and unholy. And Ezekiel looks upon the nation of Israel as a priest and he says, "This nation is unholy." And so you have a great deal of emphasis on the sinfulness of the nation Israel and the proof of that sinfulness. He was also concerned with the care of the temple and the sacrificial worship, and that's why you have a great deal of emphasis in the 40th through the 48th chapter on the new temple and the new worship. It's just like the revelation that a engineer might get when he starts studying the book of Exodus. I know engineers who have devoted their lifetime to studying the tabernacle, because God speaks to them through figures, through dimensions. Ezekiel was a priest, and God spoke to Ezekiel through the dimensions of the temple, through the ritual of sacrifice. So he was concerned about this. God speaks to us where we are. The second characteristic of Ezekiel was that he was a prophet. He was called of God to be a prophet. And as Bill has mentioned several times, the characteristic of a prophet is that he receives the word of the Lord. That he receives direct revelation from God and passes it on. And so the word of the Lord came unto me 49 times, according to Ezekiel. The other responsibility that he has, however, is a specific responsibility of being a watchman. A watchman was stationed on a city wall, and he saw the coming of the enemy. And as the enemy came, he was to warn people, to make preparations. So Ezekiel was given the task of being a watchman. He was to stand up and to proclaim that judgment was coming. Judgment was imminent. God is going to punish the nation of Israel. Prepare. Repent. So he proclaims the sin of the nation and calls upon the people to prepare through repentance. There are a couple things about Ezekiel that I did not put on the overhead that we ought to deal with. It may bother you. One of the things that may bother you is the dumbness of this prophet. The prophet was told to be silent, that he could not speak. And you find this in Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 26 and 27. "Moreover, I will make your tongue stick to the roof of your mouth, so that you will be dumb and cannot be a man who rebukes them, for they are a rebellious house. But when I speak to you, I will open your mouth, and you will say to them, 'Thus says the Lord God.' He who hears, let him hear, and he who refuses, let him refuse, for they are a rebellious house. But he was to be dumb. He could not open his mouth. There are two ways of explaining this, that he was totally unable to speak and that he wrote his prophecies. This is probably not true, because you have several references in the book to the fact that he said something or he spoke something. The dumbness, however, is explained in Ezekiel 3:27 as being partial. When I speak to you, I will open your mouth and you will say to them. So that it's a partial dumbness. And the purpose of this was that the nation had heard the message so long that they had become dull of hearing. Their hearts had grown cold to the word. Their ears were not opened. Their minds were stopped. And consequently, God said, I will not speak to them anymore by the word. That is why Ezekiel turns to the type of ministry that he does. And that's why the book of Ezekiel is so full of symbols. He acts out the judgment of God. He does a number of symbolic acts. He makes a tile, for instance, and sets siege to this tile. He cuts his hair and burns part of it, throws part of it to the wind, and hides part of it. So many of his actions were symbolic acts. Acts that were designed to teach people through symbolic acts and to get their attention. You know, if the mule is so dumb that he won't pay any attention, hit him with a board. And that's what they were having to do. They were not listening any longer. So Ezekiel had to do a number of very queer things to get their attention. Probably the most harsh one of these was the death of his wife. Ezekiel had to lose his wife to prophesy to the nation. He lost his dearest possession, his wife, to teach Israel the lesson that they would lose their dear Jerusalem, that they would lose the blessing that God had in store for them. So Ezekiel became now a prophet of signs. And so you do have a number of signs in his book. Okay, I'm sorry we've taken so long to get to the outline of the book. The book of Ezekiel can be divided into three parts. Actually, you can divide it up into two parts. Three parts. And in each part, God is sovereign. God is sovereignly in control of Judah. He will punish Judah for their sins. And so the first 24 chapters deal with the denunciation of Judah. You have the call and commission of the prophet in chapter 1 through 3. In chapter 1, he sees a vision of the glory of God, and he is commissioned in chapter 2 and 3. In chapter 4 through 7, Jerusalem is to be destroyed, and you have four signs of the destruction of Israel. The tile, the line on the side, and you have two other signs, with three explanations following it. Once he got their attention through the signs, he was to explain the judgment of God, that Jerusalem would be destroyed. Chapter 8 through chapter 11, the glory departs from Jerusalem. God's glory departs. Chapter 12 through 19, you have two signs, three allegories, and in chapter 18, the principle of individual responsibility, all announcing the certainty of judgment. One of these signs, one of these allegories concerns the vine. A vine is good for only two things, either producing fruit or being burned for heat. And because Israel was not producing any fruit, God was certain to judge it. Until there is fruit on the vine, there will be judgment. A vine is good only for burning. In chapters 20 through 24, he gives the moral necessity of judgment. And in chapter 20, he reviews the history, showing that all throughout history, God patiently reserves punishment because God did not want to profane his name. Had he punished Israel when he brought them out of Egypt, the nations would have said God was not able to deliver his people. Had he punished Israel when they first got into the land of the Canaanites, the Israelites and the nations round about would have said, God is not any better than the Canaanite God. God is not able to deliver the Israelites. God is not able to bring them into the land. And so Israel existed on sufferance for a long time. God did not want to profane his name. The 21st chapter is the sign of the sword. A sharpened sword will be let loose upon Israel. Judgment is imminent. Chapter 22, the uncleanness of Jerusalem. And chapter 23, the allegory of the harlots, showing that Israel constantly chased after the nations of the ancient Near East rather than be obedient to God. In the center section of the book, chapters 25 through chapter 32, judgments are pronounced upon the nation. These prophecies, denunciation of Judah and the fate of Judah, take place during the period 592 to 588, before the siege of Jerusalem. While Jerusalem is being besieged, before the city falls, Ezekiel pronounces judgments on the nation. You are looking at my judgment upon Israel. You are looking at me punishing my nation. Do you think that you can escape? If my nation, which is called by my name, cannot escape the judgment of God because of their unrighteousness, do you think you can escape? So the next 2 years, 588 through 586, are spent in prophecies not to the nation of Israel, but prophecies to the nation of the ancient Near East, the nations round about them. The final chapters, 33 through 48, deal with the restoration of Israel. First of all, in chapter 33, Ezekiel is reappointed to be the watchman again. And in 34 through 37, you have the renewal of Israel. First of all, they are regathered in 34. They are prospered in the land in 35. In contrast to the destitution or desolation of Edom, these chapters ought to go together. 35 and the first part of 36 actually deal with the prosperity of the land of Israel. And the latter part of 36 deals with the regeneration and the restoration of Israel. Chapter 37, you may recall, is the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones. Chapter 38 and 39, they are invaded and protected against the king of the north called Gog, who is the prince of Russia or prince of Magog. They are protected after this invasion. In the final chapters, 40 through 48, Israel enjoys a new life. First of all, they are worshiping at a new temple. The glory of God has returned, and the worship of God has been reinstituted, and they enjoy a new land. The land is redivided. So there are a couple of things that I'd like to go into with you as far as selected studies. If I don't say something about the first chapter, I'm sure somebody's going to ask me about it. One of the things that Ezekiel is known for is the glory of God. He gives you more information about the glory of God than any of the other prophets. He sees a vision of the glory of God in his introductory or initial vision in Ezekiel chapter 1. In Ezekiel chapter 8 through 11, the glory of the Lord must depart from Israel and from Jerusalem because of the sinfulness of the people. They have worshipped images. They have worshipped animals. They have worshipped Tammuz. They have worshipped the sun, but they have not worshipped God. And the altars and the images are placed in place of the altar of God, and God turns his back on the people. You will not worship me, so I will not remain in your temple any longer. So in chapter 9, verse 3, the glory of the Lord, the Shekinah glory, which dwelt above the Ark of the Covenant, removes to the threshold. In chapter 10, verses 18 and 19, it removes to the east gate of the temple. And in chapter 11, verses 22 through 23, it moves to the Mount of Olives and leaves the land of Palestine altogether, only to return after the regeneration of Israel, the restoration of the temple, and the restoration of Israel to the land of Palestine, in the return in 43, 2 and 5. We've spoken about the symbolism of Ezekiel. Ezekiel has a number of visions. The hand of the Lord came upon me, or the Spirit took me up and brought me in a vision. The first vision is the vision of the glory of God. Now, I'm not sure that I can completely depict this for you. I can't draw any pictures of it because I'm a lousy drawer, for one thing. But let me just briefly describe in my own words what I think Ezekiel saw. And he, in turn, remember, was only trying to describe God's glory in terms which were familiar to him. He lived in the land of Babylon, and he was familiar with chariots, not familiar with automobiles. He was familiar with chariots. He was also familiar with composite beasts, some of the protective genies who guarded the gates and guarded the palaces of the monarchs of the ancient Near East were composite beasts, with the body of a cow, with wings of an eagle, with the face of a lion, or the face of a man, and with a mane of a lion, composite beasts. And so Ezekiel was trying to describe to people what the glory of God looked like to him. When you get to heaven, I do not feel at all that you will see chariots, a lion and a bull, etc. You will not see those figures at all, because you're not conditioned to seeing that way. This was merely a revelation of God's glory in terms that Ezekiel could understand. Now, what I think you have here in these composite beasts, first of all, start with the figure itself, which are called living creatures in chapter 1. They are called cherubim in chapter 10. This living being was a being which had four faces. The face of man pointed forward. The face of an ox, and the, what was the other face? Anybody remember the other face right offhand? Face of a lion. He had a face of a lion and a face of an ox pointing in, out to the side, and a face of an eagle coming in the back. And he had wings with hands underneath. And these, I think that what you have here are four beings which were standing like this with their wings somewhat like this. The wings were touching and they formed a square. The man's face was forward, the ox and the lion faced to one side, and the eagle faced to the rear. Alongside of these beings, and probably connected to these beings, were wheels. Now, these wheels were somewhat like a gyroscope, as I would understand it, because they consisted of a wheel within a wheel. And the purpose of this wheel within a wheel, one wheel, like this, set at cross angles, the purpose of this wheel was so that it could move very rapidly in any direction, forward, backwards, and to either side, instantaneously, to move very rapidly. The purpose of the wheels then was for instantaneous or rapid movement. Now, above these beasts, probably on the wingtips of these living creatures, there was a platform, or it's called a firmament. It's a platform or a beaten, stamped out, thin shield upon which the throne of God was put. This, shield or platform was made out of very precious stone. And on the throne above sat God. And, God was depicted somewhat in human form with fiery loins. Loins are this part. And fire bursting forth. And so the basic picture that Ezekiel gives you of God himself is a picture of fiery judgment, fiery holiness, which is the picture that is given throughout the rest of the book of the Bible, that God is a consuming fire, that God is absolute holiness, and he is depicted as fire. To come face to face with God was to invite death. It would be just like being cast into the furnace by the Babylonians. The three Hebrew children could have expected death because the furnace was heated. And the men who threw them in did experience death. To come face to face with God, to come face to face with the glory of God, to see the glory of God, was to invite certain death. You and I have been given the privilege, not only of seeing the glory of God, but being temples for the glory of God. Jesus Christ, who is the image of God, who is the glory of God, has taken up residence in each one of you, of us. God is in our midst. God in the glory of Jesus Christ dwells within us. And he is as much concerned about sin in our lives as he was concerned about the sin in the lives of Israel. Dr. Walke, who shares the office next door to me, has often expressed the fact that he is an adulteress. Not an adulteress in the sense that he runs around with other women, but he does not have a single eye. He covets. He covets things. He covets knowledge. He covets material things. All of which are just like worshiping idols. All of which are just like worshiping beasts. You and I are to have a single eye. We are to have an eye for God, because the glory of God indwells us, as it did the temple of God. And the glory of God removed from Ezekiel and from the land of Palestine. We are told that God will never leave us, but we can certainly grieve the Spirit. We cannot grieve him away, but we can certainly grieve him and lose fellowship with him. So we should be as every bit as concerned about the glory of God and the holiness of God as Ezekiel was. See, I've taken too much time. That I guess I should have expected that the first time around. The book was a long book. Are there any questions that I might be able to clear up? I'm not an expert in the book. I've begun to study it just like you have.